I'm going to get started talking about the difference of enteroatmospheric versus enterocutaneous fistulas. Because so often we confuse these terms and or others confuse them, and it is hard to keep track of what a cutaneous fistula is versus an atmospheric fistula. To start off with, I have no financial interest in anything related to this talk. I used to be a consultant for several companies trying to develop enterocutaneous fistula device. I do enjoy helping patients through the journey of enteroatmospheric fistulas. Believe it or not, I learned a long time ago that when I started as a young surgeon, that if you pick up something that none of your partners want to do, they keep you around. The other is that I actually do enjoy taking patients through this because they are god-awful problems, the fistulas are, but getting them through that is somewhat agonizing but also filled with a lot of joy at the end. Hopefully we'll be able to talk and understand the difference between atmospheric fistulas and cutaneous ones, especially the higher morbidity and mortality associated with the enteroatmospheric ones. We're going to talk about the potential causes of them versus the cutaneous, as well as review some of the changes in outcomes over the last 40 years of dealing with these fistulas. Let's talk about history first. Fistula is a word, is of Latin origin, means pipe, reed, or tube, and it actually is an abnormal connection between two epithelial-lined organs, except really in context of an enteroatmospheric fistula, because that is from a mucosalized epithelial-lined organ to the atmosphere. The written history of these fistulas can be traced back actually to the Book of Judges in the Old Testament of the Bible, in an account that describes a fistula that developed when King Eglon was stabbed and killed eventually by Ehud, who actually saved the kingdom of Israel with that stabbing. Intestinal wounds were described in Hindu writings as early as 600 BC. Celsus observed that with a small bowel injury, only expectant care could be provided, but the large intestine can be sutured, not with any certain assurance, but because the doubtful hope is preferable to certain despair. And even as late as the 16th century, these intestinal wounds were managed expectantly, and patients either succumbed, healed, or suffered in a fistula itself. And there have been a lot of other mentions in the history of fistulas, from the hemiand or eponymous hernia, which was an appendix with a fistula. John Hunter, who's considered the father of modern surgery, actually had his observations on fistulas and the tendency for spontaneous closure only if the contents of the viscus becomes less. The 18th century surgeon Lorenz Heister actually described his observations with them, with the lips of the intestine so wounded would sometimes quite unexpectedly adhere to the wound of the abdomen, and actually is what his recommendations were actually to suture the wound to the edges of the abdomen. And if you think about it, maintaining and managing these fistulas are really the beginning of the field of ostomy surgery. So this is really the definition of an enteroatmospheric fistula and why it's so different. There's specific characteristics: the absence of a fistula tract, the lack of well-vascularized surrounding tissue, and often the location is within an open abdomen, the peritoneum itself, or a wound. And as you can see here, this is part of the small intestine in the middle of a big open wound, and this describes this kind of fistula quite well. There are other classifications which I think are important, and in these pictures you can see an open wound with some granulation, but you can see these fistulas on the side. This is enteroatmospheric. These are enteroatmospheric, and these are enterocutaneous, obviously a tract into the skin. And they're high output versus low output, and the moderate 200 to 500 cc's are considered. And a lot of the enteroatmospheric fistulas can be in that mid-range, and a lot of times our management is to try to get them into that mid-range or lower. Many of them are iatrogenic, some are spontaneous, half are related to anastomotic leaks, and not necessarily actually with two edges of the bowel are sewn, but also just either serosal tear repairs or other type of suture on intestines. And they can be from all these others, you know, from our ways we do adhesiolysis, from radiation. Those patients that I've taken care of with radiation-induced fistulas are some of the hardest, as we all know, to take care of. And of course, we'll get into damage control and other components. There's another classification, the organ of origin, which is a classification which I wanted to include mainly because of the fact of showing type 4. Regardless of the organ itself, if it's enteroatmospheric, it's a type 4. So the others are type 1, 2, and 3, depending on what part of the bowel is involved. The true incidence of an enteroatmospheric fistula and what we do is really hard to determine, mainly because of the confusion of the term. And we throw around enterocutaneous and enteroatmospheric all the time. And there are different, but because of the classification, it's hard to know what the true incidence is. One large study of over 2,300 patients, they showed that those requiring trauma laparotomy identified fistula development in 1.5%, only 36 out of 2,300, but that's still a pretty significant amount. And they also showed that these fistulas also had a higher incidence of intensive care length of stay, hospital length of stay, and the mean hospital charges were quite high in comparison to the different types. It also shows, depends on the etiology, pancreatic necrosis patients tend to have a high incidence of intestinal fistulas. And of course, trauma patients, like we mentioned in some studies, up to 25% of severe open abdomens. And abdominal sepsis itself has a high one, mainly because of the, and I put in quotation marks, spontaneous, because we might say it's spontaneous, but a lot of times they develop because of what we do and how we manage the wound. But these enteroatmospheric fistulas occur more often in the patients undergoing surgical procedures in an open abdomen. And the mortality rate for enteroatmospheric fistulas are listed anywhere from 18 to 64%. They can be quite damaging and high mortality for patients. I think it's important to look at the factors affecting spontaneous closure. And as you can see, those that are favorable are surgical type etiology. The length, if it's a long fistula tract, if it's an end fistula, like a true enterocutaneous ones, and a low output, and anything we can do to get it lower in the output can mean it can be more favorable to close. And of course, if you've eliminated sepsis and or the patient is being managed at a tertiary or quaternary facility, the more chances ability to be favorable to close. Unfavorable are all these are related, as we mentioned, plus enteroatmospheric ones, because once it's mucosalized, as we all know, it's difficult to close spontaneously. I, in my 25-year career, have actually had a few close, but it's a long monthly project or several-year project to get them closed. And if you have a patient with ongoing sepsis, it is very difficult to have favorable closure. I also wanted to talk about the mechanical explanation for development. I think this is where some of the spontaneous fistulas are actually coming from, how we are managing wounds. And this was a publication just recently, but it talked about how we are managing the open abdomens. And those patients that have developed that granulation tissue over top of the intestines start that process of what's called a plastron, almost like a turtle shell. And so bowels themselves being exposed, if you keep them moist, they probably won't be very harmful, but some of the other forces are. And once the patient develops that superficial layer of granulation tissue, it acts like a balloon, and it surrounds that intra-abdominal mass to form that turtle shell. So when that happens, and you have any lateral retraction of the oblique abdominal muscles, it can actually add some tensile forces that those tissues aren't used to. And it potentially increases the tearing of the granulation tissue, and because the bowel is adherent to it, can tear that also. And these are some graphic components of it, where you actually have that granulation tissue and those lateral retraction forces of the abdominal muscles. And if it starts and you have that crack of the granulation tissue, the bowel underneath it, if the force is great enough, will tear a hole. So it's spontaneous, but it actually is from how we're managing it. And this is exactly what happened to this patient. In managing with he developed three fistula tract, all with that component of lateral forces. There are other ways to prevent these fistulas, and because of the high morbidity associated with them. And so when we are manipulating bowel during operations, it's important to avoid any type of de-serosalizations. The intestines in patients with open abdomens really need to be meticulously protected, prevent desiccation, prevent those tensile forces. And I actually believe that when you have patients with open abdomens, that they really need to be managed by really the senior leadership of the team to really baby the wounds. And if you have free access to the wound by all members of the staff, almost can guarantee an enteroatmospheric fistula. There are other preventive techniques, and one of those is avoidance of hyperresuscitation and resultant bowel edema. Now, I personally agree that that does happen, but I do think there are other components of a patient that also develops the edema because of the severe capillary leak. But we do need to be more judicious when we're resuscitating patients, and that's one of the causes that's been shown to be increasing interatmospheric fistulas. And the type of abdominal closure, they've looked at it, and yes, some, like negative pressure, can improve wound coverage, but there's no difference in developing interatmospheric fistula. It's how we manage the wounds themselves. But there are some components with negative pressure I wanted to mention, because if you use negative pressure devices, there can be an increase of that problem of fistulas. And that if you have frequent re-explorations, if you have a negative pressure device on for longer than 13 days, it has a higher incidence of developing interatmospheric fistulas. So the optimal duration is really around 13 days if you're going to use negative pressure. And one of the other components I think is important to look at is when you have negative pressure, there's studies that have looked at any type of that negative pressure can decrease the blood flow when you're using the blood flow to that tissue. So if you're using negative pressure, you have to be wary of that. So if someone has on high dose pressors or other things, we have to consider reducing that pressure, because that can be a higher incidence of developing a fistula. And I do think this is another component, as we are now seeing more and more with the nutritional components of our patients before we do elective operations. And I'm throwing this out here because there are no great randomized studies, and I'm sure we can talk about it in the panel after all the presentations, because I do think some of the micronutrients that have been shown that are really low in a lot of our trauma patients and are also low in a lot of our acute care surgery patients. And perhaps we need to look at that prior to doing complex operations. I want to mention this as one of the last slides, talking about where we come. And I think this is a great article that they presented at Mass General just a few blocks away. In 1970, they had, looking at the operative success, was only 70%. Now it's 92%. The actual use of nutrition, parenteral nutrition, is down. And the mortality is much better now, over 45 years. And I'm hoping that some of you in the room, the younger surgeons, can be here in about 30, 40 years talking about how enteroatmospheric fistulas are non-existent, or at least the mortality is zero. I hope we've been able to show that there is a big difference between the two, and I think we really need to start mentioning enteroatmospheric when you actually have one in the literature, as well as in coding. That's a whole other issue, of course. We've actually hopefully shown that desiccation, resuscitation volumes can be associated with higher incidence of fistulas, enteroatmospheric fistulas, and that prevention is really the only way to really cure these, and that we have shown some improvement. I do have some references included. This next talk is Succus Nutrition Infection, Managing the Patient from Oh My Goodness Towards Sanity, by Dr. Napolitano.